listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to Lunch with the Loveologist with your host, Wendy Stragar, right here on LA Talk Radio.
When you love somebody and you want to make them happy, you take a little time to make a little rhythm and rhyme. You care for one another, be good to each other. You might need a little lotion to get things in motion. Rub it on your body, it's good for your body. It's good, clean love. Good, clean love. Good, clean love. Good, clean love. Take your love and make it stronger. Make it last a whole lot longer.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Lunch with the Loveologist with Wendy Stragar, brought to you by Good Clean Love. Today, we are really excited and happy to be able to welcome Deborah Taj Anipol with us. She is probably the foremost expert in the country on polyamory in the 21st century, which is the name of her new book. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you.
And Deborah, should I call you Taj or Deborah? How do people refer?
Oh, people call me both, but maybe we'll do Deborah just to keep it simple today.
Okay. So Deborah is a PhD clinical psychologist from University of Washington. And in addition to her latest book, which just came out 2 weeks ago, right?
Right.
Yeah, so congratulations on that. This most recent book, Polyamory in the 21st Century, she also wrote Polyamory, The New Love Without Limits, and prior to that, a book I've seen, The Seven Natural Laws of Love. Do you still work on the magazine, Loving More?
I haven't been involved with that for a while.
But yeah. That magazine is still going on, though, right?
It's still going on. It's kind of in a transition to an online magazine, but I think there's still some print versions happening occasionally.
Uh-huh. So, so you're a clinical psychologist, and you've been involved in the polyamory movement for, you said, close to 30 years. So let's give some definitions for our listeners about what polyamory, what does it mean, and how many people are involved in the country, any kind of facts you can give to sort of set the stage for our listeners about what we're going to talk about today.
Okay, well, I'll start with what does it mean, because I find that what I mean by it is not always what other people mean by it.
Uh-huh,
and
I think that's true.
So when I wrote the first Love Without Limits book, which was published in 1992, I defined polyamory as a way of loving that allows love to flow, that simply gets out of the way and acknowledges that love is bigger than we are. So it could take many different forms. And although an individual or a couple could try to have an ideal that they want their relationship to conform to, the truth is that love goes its own way and it's bigger than we are.
Uh-huh.
So if we take our egos and our beliefs out of the way and allow love to lead, often, especially over the course of a lifetime, it grows and expands to include more than just one other person. And so for the way most people think about polyamory is that it's about loving and perhaps being sexually involved with more than one person at the same time. So multiple partners is often involved in polyamory, but to me it's still polyamory if there's two people who, their truth is that they just want to be with each other. It's not that they swore that they would forsake all others. It's just that's what they want.
So actually, but the definition of
polyamory.
Yeah, but so polyamory is not just with a two-partner couple. I mean, the definition of polyamory, just so we're clear for the listeners, is actually multiple partners that everybody agrees are it's okay. So it's not like one partner goes and has an affair and is secretive, but it's like the both people in the original couple say, yes, I understand you want to have a relationship with Miss whoever else, and in fact, sometimes that third person is in relationship to both partners. Is that right?
Exactly. There's a lot of different forms that it can take once we give up the idea that it looks like two people who are emotionally and sexually exclusive with each other. It might be a committed threesome. It might be an open couple. It might be
an open couple, an open couple, meaning that both people have relationships with other people, and that everything is on the up and up, and everybody knows that other people are having sexual relations. And I mean, so it seems like in the conversations I've had in the past that one of the key distinguishers of healthy polyamorous relationships is the capacity to really communicate honestly. What would you say about that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the distinction here, is that nothing is kept secret. It's all consensual. And, you know, I hate to say this, but I found that even people who make an agreement that they can have other partners sometimes still end up having secret affairs. So
what's that about, you think? I mean, why would they do that if they're already in an open relationship? What would behoove them to have a secret affair on top of that? That's sort of amazing to me. I've never imagined that. But why do you think that happens with people?
Well, two main reasons. One is that some people really enjoy that thrill of the illicit. They, you know, it's just not as much fun if it's agreed on. And
that's an interesting idea.
Yeah, the other thing is that sometimes even though people have made this agreement, they don't quite trust it. They don't quite believe that either it's really going to be okay with their partner, or that, you know, they may be afraid that it's going to change the dynamics of the relationship, which it probably will.
Oh, it definitely will.
Yeah. Yeah.
So do you think that people... Sorry, go ahead.
It's kind of a way of exerting control and power if you're having a secret relationship.
And so I imagine that in the same way that affects monogamous relationships, it also affects polyamorous relationships when people find out that people are doing things secretly, because, you know, the polyamorous, you know, the whole sense of polyamory is that there's this shared trust. You know, I mean, if it's not that, then it's just, I mean, what is it? You know, so, I mean, do you find you have clients and people you work with that have done damage to their relationship in the same way that you'd find in a monogamous couple because they've done secret affairs? I mean, you do the same damage, right?
Yes, maybe even more so. Because it wasn't just assumed that there would be honesty. It was talked about and agreed on.
Right. One of the basic principles of polyamory that I learned about, and I'm going to ask you two questions here so you can answer whichever one you want, is this idea of compersion. Did I say it right?
Yes.
Compersion, which is a theory of wanting. Well, I'm going to let you describe the idea of compersion because I know you have a whole book on it. And so why don't you answer that question first, and I'll give you the other one. So what is compersion,
okay,
and how does that sort of form the basis of what polyamory is about?
Well, the word is a made-up word that means the opposite of jealousy. That is, having joy and pleasure that your beloved is loving or being loved by someone else. And for some people, that's a really alien idea. For other people, they hear the word, they don't know what it means, and when they find out, they go, oh, I've always felt that way. I didn't know there was a word for it.
Huh.
But for most of us, growing up in this culture, we learn that we're supposed to be jealous and possessive. And so this is one of many factors that promotes jealousy. It's always easier from a psychological point of view to substitute one feeling or emotion from another. So rather than just trying not to be jealous, it's actually much easier and more fulfilling to have enjoyment about your beloved's happiness. And many people tell me this is actually the most effective strategy for them to deal with jealousy, is to, instead of focusing on what they may be fearing or missing out on, to focus on the happiness of the person they love.
I've never heard it talked about as the opposite of jealousy, but I know that that's actually jealousy is sort of I think it's not just the culture. I mean, I believe that it's an emotion that's in us, in a, you know, it's just part of what it means to be human, you know, that we have that, and that, you know, that how we work with that feeling says a lot about what we do with our life. But, you know, but the jealousy that comes, you know, when people are sexually intimate is almost its own brand or own type of jealousy. And so, you know, I think for a lot of people, when they hear about polyamory, that's the thing that's most sort of challenging for them to imagine what happens to that feeling. So I would guess that in your counseling with most of your clients that have this lifestyle, that comes up fairly frequently, does it not?
Absolutely. Anybody who thinks that they don't have any jealousy is probably in denial, or they've kept themselves out of situations in which their jealousy would get triggered. I totally agree with you. It's human to experience jealousy, and particularly sexual jealousy, but a lot of the conditions under which it arises are part of the culture, are things that we're taught.
Right.
For example, that if your partner's not jealous, that means they don't really love you.
Uh-huh. Well, or, you know, or that, you know, I mean, so jealousy when it comes to sexual intimacy, you know, like I said, I feel like is an innate emotion, but I feel like it also has a lot to do with the level of vulnerability that people feel around their sexuality. So I'm guessing, I don't know if this is true, but I would presume, and maybe you could tell me, that people who practice polyamory would tend to be more sexually open and not as vulnerable as people who would be more fearful of that. I mean, do you think there's some truth in that?
Well, one would hope, but in fact, I think some people may be attracted to polyamory in order to heal their sexual issues, because it certainly does bring them forward, certainly does confront you with any sexual insecurity or wounding that you have.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it's already kind of complicated enough. I mean, my feeling about polyamory is that, you know, I've been in a marriage for 26 years, and you know, and I actually early on in my marriage had a couple of, you know, extramarital affairs before I had any kids or anything. And so it wasn't something that we had agreed on or whatever, although we weren't living in the same country at that time. But it was so difficult for us to get through that space afterwards and to come to a place of trust and, you know, reestablish our ability to be intimate with each other, that, you know, it's like when I think about how you do that and the level of communication that you need, you know, among three or four people, it's sort of mind-boggling for me, because just for people to succeed at that between two people is hard. So, you know, I mean, is that really, would you say that that's the majority of the kind of counseling work you do with people in polyamorous situations, is how they communicate and work through their feelings?
Well, the communication is definitely a big part of it, as is jealousy. But some of the coaching I do with people in polyamorous relationships is not really so much about either of those things, but just all the usual issues that people may encounter in a couple. Sometimes people have a very solid and comfortable relationship with a long-term partner, and they almost need to bring someone else in who triggers them a bit for the growth to occur.
So can you give an example of that, or you know, or how that works, a threesome like that?
Well, yeah.
And actually, one of my other questions is it usually that both people are interested in that, or does one person sort of get the, you know, fall in love or become interested in somebody and then bring it to the other partner and say, would you be willing to try this? Or how does that usually go down?
Well, it's different for different people. There was very recently an article published in Psychotherapy Networker by a very conventional East Coast therapist, but who was willing to be truthful and open-minded about the fact that, you know, most people are not monogamous over the long term. And, you know, you mentioned yourself that earlier in your relationship you had, because of circumstances most likely, been involved in some affairs. And that's actually perhaps the majority of people who think they're in monogamous relationships, one or both partners ends up going outside the relationship. Now, she's calling this the new monogamy, which I find fascinating. And she calls it the new monogamy. I have a conversation with her rather than polyamory, because there's still this intention to keep the primary bond between two people. Uh-huh. Now, that's what in polyamory we call that type of polyamory, open marriage or open couple.
Uh-huh.
But it's the same idea of intending that your primary emotional commitment is with one person, and then you negotiate ways that you can open it up, whether that's just sexually or whether that's actually a long-term secondary relationship or friendship that includes sex. There's a lot of different ways it could look, or it could look like a relationship with another couple. All kinds of things can happen from there, but I just find it fascinating. She's calling this the new monogamy, and precisely because so many people do find, especially over a lifetime, that actually they don't want to limit their either sexual or intimate experience to just one other person.
Uh-huh.
And so the question becomes, if you're in a couple relationship, how can you do that and strengthen the connection you already have rather than destroying it? And a lot of people hope they can do that by having a secret affair. They're thinking short term. In the short term, oh, I'll just have this other experience. It won't take away from my marriage, and my partner will never find out, and everything will be fine. But the reality is that consciously or unconsciously, sooner or later, the partner does find out, and you can imagine that it's much harder to deal with the damage done by the betrayal than it would have been to negotiate opening up the relationship.
Yeah, no, actually, I hear about that. And I mean, for just couples, you know, and because infidelity, I don't know, 60% of the time actually manages to ruin the relationship. I mean, it ends relationships more frequently than it does anything else. And at least in this country, you know, in other countries, when people have infidelity, you know, in France, it's so expected that, you know, people wouldn't divorce over that. But, you know, in Italy and Spain, you know, they just sort of presume infidelity, and people do it discreetly, and it doesn't affect the primary relationship. But in America, it really does affect the primary relationship, usually and frequently ends it. And I would imagine even in polyamory, when people have secret affairs, it usually ends relationships too, right? Because the...
Well, honestly, I can't say what's usual. But I think, you know, even though it's extremely destructive and painful to the relationship, perhaps it's a little easier to cope with in polyamory because it's not confronting this belief that if you have sex with someone else, it's all over between us. It really just becomes about the secrecy, which could be about anything. Yeah. You know, you could get mistrustful of your partner because they spent money and kept it a secret, or they had an addiction and kept it a secret. You know, it doesn't have to be about sex.
Right. So just as a brief sort of historical accounting, you know, polyamory is ancient, right? I mean, there's artistic accounts of it and writings about polyamorous relationships back to the Egyptians. Am I correct on that?
Yes, it goes way, way back. However, in recorded history, mostly what we see is a very patriarchal version where it's okay for the man to have more than one lover or wife, but not for the woman. And so sometimes I refer to polyamory as equal opportunity. People use the word polygamy actually in that sense of just the patriarchal polygamy, but really it could be a man or a woman who has multiple partners. And that's one of the reasons we switched to the word polyamory, is to get away from that association. There's a kind of a myth that men want polygamy, women want monogamy. And what I've seen is this is almost entirely socially constructed.
What's that? Say that again, that women actually are interested in polyamorous relationships, that I'm confused. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Women seem to be just as interested and perhaps even better equipped emotionally and physically for multiple partner relationships. But, you know, it wasn't so long ago, and in fact, in some parts of the world, it's still true that women can be having more than one partner. You know, the stigma attached to women who are sexually empowered, particularly with more than one person, is huge, whereas for men it's kind of expected and even admired in a way.
Well, yeah, I mean, right now, today, there's women being stoned in other countries for having an affair. So, you know, in 2010, you know, and the men, you know, are not punished at all in those countries, which is really bizarre. So sexuality is certainly not an equal opportunity thing around the world. But even right here, you know, your book is titled Polyamory in the 21st Century. And is it something that you discuss polyamory around the world, or do you really focus on just the U.S., or how are you looking at it in the book?
Well, I did a lot of traveling in the last couple of years. And so one chapter discusses both polyamory as it's practiced and also the polyamory movement in a number of other countries. And that's one of the things that changed over the last 30 years, because as you correctly observed, in Europe, there hasn't been such a big deal about secret affairs as long as they're discreet. But the idea of honesty and openness is something that really came out of the United States and has since spread around the world.
I don't know, did you go to Europe, and is there a pretty big polyamory movement there in Europe, or?
It's growing, and I find that in general, the Europeans, because there's less pressure on people to be monogamous in the first place, are a little less interested in polyamory than, for example, in India or China, where there's less opportunity for people to just do what they want, and, you know, as long as it's discreet, anything goes.
So the places where, that's actually surprising. I would think actually the more sexually relaxed attitudes in Europe would actually sort of cultivate a bigger interest in polyamory instead of the opposite. So because they feel like they can just act out their needs in the this new monogamy, so to speak, you know, that you referred to earlier, where they have the freedom to be with somebody, but it doesn't necessarily negatively impact their primary relationship, means that they're less interested in sort of opening up their relationship to sort of a polyamorous open couple or inviting somebody else in or whatever. So is that what you found?
Again, Europe is kind of a big place, and there's a lot of differences. So in Scandinavia, polyamory seems to be more popular than in Southern Europe.
Right, right. Well, that makes sense, actually. You can imagine that. But India is a place that I would not have guessed that polyamory is growing, and you feel like that's because the restrictions around people's sexualities so intense that although there is some history of multiple partners there, but like you said, usually for the man and not for the woman. So
right. If you go back far enough, though, in India, if you go back before the patriarchy, or even before the British and the Muslim invasion, you do find that both men and women were not particularly required to be monogamous. Now, depending on their life circumstances, both economically and spiritually, there's a range of different possibilities for people. And it may just be that I've tapped into the subculture in India that's particularly interested in polyamory. But you have to remember, in India, a lot of people still have arranged marriages.
Right.
And so when you marry based on someone else's decision, and if you play by the rules without any prior sexual experience, it's really the kind of situation which calls out for polyamory, where people can expand their sexual experience, where they can preserve the family bond, which is very important still in that culture, but perhaps engage with someone who's more sexually compatible than the person you happen to end up with, because I'm quite sure whoever is arranging these marriages, their primary consideration is not sexual compatibility. And in fact, that's not actually a great basis for a marriage.
Right.
That's
interesting. would you say, I think I read, there was like a Time magazine article, or maybe it was Newsweek, a couple years ago, about the polyamory movement. And I think they said something like 1 million people in the U.S. were involved in that, or am I right? Or is it 5 million people who are in polyamorous relationships? Or do you have any sense of the percentage, the numbers in this country?
Well, there's never been the kind of research or survey that would answer that question. And so a lot of numbers are tossed around. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, we have no idea. And my own estimate would be 10% of the adults are...
10%?
10% are doing something that I would call polyamory. Now, whether that's being single and dating several people over a long period of time, or whether that's, maybe someone was in a marriage for 20 years and then decided to open up the relationship Maybe they did that for 10 years and then, you know, ended up just together again. You know, it's not like...
Well, but so I think that's a pretty wide definition of polyamory, though. I mean, that's the widest definition of polyamory I've ever heard. But if we're talking about just people who are in a marriage... You know, some kind of committed relationship. So this is the population I'm trying to get at, right? Is the people who are in a committed relationship who either through a third person or through, as you were saying, an open couple decide to add, you know, other relationships openly, other sexual relationships openly to their primary relationship. That's the polyamory that I'm getting at. And, or, you know, where there's multiple couples or, you know, that it's all consensual. It's not like swinging or something like that, but it's, you know, it's a lifestyle that people are choosing. And I think that the article said it was between 1 million and 5 million, and I wish I had looked that up before, but that's what they had recorded. And I think based on some of that magazine that you had been a founder of, Loving More, and there's a couple organizations that are associated with that. And I think those numbers came from internally in the community like that. So
the thing is, nobody knows, not the people at Newsweek and not the people at Loving More magazine. These are just guesses, educated or uneducated guesses. And the question always comes up, do we include swinging? Because what you just described to me actually is pretty much what most people would define as swinging. That is a couple who decides to have sex with other people, whether it's another couple or a single person. And
yeah, but except
that...
Yeah, go ahead.
One of the distinctions that people usually make between polyamory and swinging is that it's not just about sex, that there is love there, that there is an emotional bond as well as a sexual encounter. So... it really becomes words, though, because I've met people in the swing community who call themselves swingers and, in fact, are practicing what I would call polyamory. And I meet people who call themselves polyamorous, but I would call what they're doing swinging. So
that's interesting.
It's kind of like, you know, the lesbian that has sex with men. It really becomes a labeling, a self-labeling thing.
Interesting. And so what would you say is the distinction between polyamory and swinging then? I mean, what's the line for you? I mean, how would you distinguish those two practices?
Well, there is no hard line. It is a gray area. Just like now we have the new monogamy. Is that polyamory or is that monogamy? Kind of a gray area. But the distinction is in swinging in general, and again, there's many individual exceptions, people who may consider themselves swingers because they still haven't heard of polyamory. But in general, what swinging is about is being sexually inclusive, having sex outside the marriage, but emotionally exclusive. Now, interestingly enough, this is the same way that the new monogamy tends to be defined. Although, in the new monogamy, it's a little bit like my definition of polyamory. In the new monogamy, it's not that you have to have sex with other people, but it's that there's no assumptions made about what that's going to look like. It's individually negotiated with each couple.
So, okay, I just want to make sure I'm clear on this. So swinging is where you're emotionally exclusive but sexually open. But see, I actually would also add, I knew some people in swinging communities, and you know, sometimes that's like is swinging always couples? Because sometimes, I mean, I guess they don't really accept people who are not in a couple, swingers. You know, you have to go as a couple to those events. I think, right? So,
right.
So,
right.
So,
that's usually the way it is.
So, I mean, like back in, you know, there was this period of time on army bases where these couples would all show up at one house and the men would all throw their keys in a hat, and the women would pick a set of keys and go home with that guy. And, you know, and that was like how sort of swinging started, you know, that it was this, you know, almost wife's big white, and it was just for this one night. And then they started these clubs, and actually that's that lifestyle attracts over 1 million people in this country too. But where there isn't any relationship, you know, it's just a sexual experience. And sometimes they'll be repeated. The same couples will swing, you know, repeatedly with each other. But there isn't, I actually got contacted by this people who have this website called On the Swing Set or something. I think that's the name of the website. And they talked about how, you know, they'll have regular get-togethers, swinging get-togethers with the same couples. But it's not quite like polyamory where, you know, the polyamorous couples really actually have a much deeper relationship than just the sexual relationship. Wouldn't you say?
Well, again, this is what we might call the official definition. In practice, there are polyamorous people that look a lot more like swingers, and there's swingers that look a lot more like polyamorous. So,
right.
Practically, I'm not sure what the distinction is.
Uh-huh. So it's a pretty gray area.
It's a very gray area, which is why I kind of come back to defining polyamory as just being more fluid about who you love both in a sexual sense, and also, with a heart connection. Some polyamorous people actually are not having sex with other people. They're just having very deep, intimate relationships that are not sexual.
And so, I actually met some people at the Bioneers show a couple of years ago, and they had actually been, both of them, in the polyamorous community in Hawaii, which I think you're pretty involved in, right? Because you spend a lot of time in Hawaii?
I've spent most of the last 5 years in Hawaii, and I can tell you that, first of all, there's seven islands which are not terribly well connected.
Yeah.
And then on each island, there's different communities. But I'm certainly not surprised to hear there are some polyamorous people in Hawaii.
Isn't there a community of polyamorous people there? I mean, I'm pretty sure there is a pretty big community. That's at least what these people told me. They had been there for quite a while. But anyway, it was interesting because at the moment that I met them, they brought up this issue that had always been in the back of my head about polyamory, or for that matter, infidelity, or for that matter, swinging, or whatever, any of these multiple relationships that take us that distract our attention or take us out of the direct intimacy with our primary partner. And I asked him if they had actually left the community and were in a monogamous relationship, the two of them. And this was after some couple of decades that they were involved. And I said, well, what made you decide to just go back to monogamy and leave that? And, did you find that, the polyamory or the other relationships just enabled you to not deal with the real problems that were in your primary relationship, that it was just an easier way to, walk away, not even walk away, but just not really dig into what it was that was at issue in your primary relationship? And he actually, in fact, said yes, that he felt that, that polyamory, even though it was a very nourishing thing in some ways, also really detracted from the work he did in his primary relationships, which, ended up ending those relationships. And that was why, in the end, he decided to not be in a polyamorous relationship with this woman. He decided he actually really loved her and wanted to just do the work with her. So I'm just wondering, in all the years that you've been doing this and the work with so many couples, do you find that polyamory actually enables you or inhibits you from really doing the deep work you need to do with your own partner, with your primary partner? You know, does that discussion come up, or, you know, I don't know. I'm just kind of wondering what your take on that is, because I feel like, you know, that we all try, you know, there's a place of effort and work and difficulty in our relationships that, you know, we divorce from, that we kind of go on from one relationship to the next. And, you know, in the polyamorous sense, we just add some other relationship in. But, you know, does it in the end just distract us from doing the actual work we need to do that's in front of us? So what do you think about that, Deborah?
I think this is one of the biggest myths about polyamory. And, yeah, of course, you can avoid your issues by going from person to person or bringing in a new partner instead of addressing what's showing up in your existing relationship. You can do the same thing in monogamy. You can avoid dealing with your jealousy by just,
totally,
you know, agreeing to only be with one person. You can avoid dealing with issues that don't happen to get brought up by this partner, but would get brought up by somebody else. So, you know, you can avoid your sexuality by picking a partner that you're not really able to go deep with sexually. So if you want to avoid your personal work, you can do that in any kind of form of relationship if that's your objective. If you want to accelerate your personal growth, you can also do that in either monogamy or polyamory, depending on your personal issues and depending on who you choose to relate with. So, you know, that I don't think either form has a corner on avoiding issues. It just depends on your situation and how you want to approach it. But there's another thing I want to address here, and that is the idea that primary partner has to mean one person, which for most people in this culture, that is what it means. And I'll even find myself, you know, referring to it that way. But the reality is that you could have two primary partners, or three or four. I think there is a limit to how many people you can really bond with and be close with, but there are many long-term stable triads, three people who all consider themselves primary with each other. Some of them are bisexual and have a sexual relationship all the way around. Others are heterosexual, and so the same-sex partners have a strong emotional bond, but not a sexual relationship.
And, you know, the interesting thing, another piece, I appreciate your take on that, and it's true. I mean, I can't disagree with anything you're saying, that you can be in a monogamous relationship and not be dealing with your issues, and, you know, and in order to deal with them, you divorce. So that's not, you know, necessarily any qualitatively better or worse than, you know, adding another person to the relationship, which either enables you or distracts you from your issues, you know. So, I mean, you end up in the same space, but I, you know, I don't know. I've always, you know, the moments when I've thought, you know, about adding another relationship in my life, although it wouldn't really work in my situation, you know, were the places where I was really discontent with what, you know, with whatever it was in my own marriage that, you know, I mean, certainly I get certain things fulfilled in my marriage and other things not. And so it was in the places that I was looking to meet other needs. And so it just, you know, seems to me that as I'm looking to meet my other needs someplace else, what I'm not doing is attending to my relationship. And so that's why I brought up that question. And as you say, you know, there's a zillion ways you can do that, but, you know, the other thing is in terms of having children in these relationships, you know, polyamory is really still not viewed culturally in a positive light. And so, you know, I know that there's some work going on about protecting the rights of polyamorous parents and, you know, because, you know, they can have their kids taken away still, I think, to this day. Isn't that true?
It has happened, and it can happen, but the reality is, unless there's someone, like a relative or perhaps a professional who makes a complaint. You know, it's not like the polyamory police are out there looking.
But it can happen. Yeah. So the point that I was going to make in that question, with making that point, is that the interesting thing is that in a culture, a polyamorous culture where people are all about being really open, that there's a lot of times secrecy about having those relationships because it's not really safe. It's not really safe to let people know, you know, if people disapprove, if you have got kids. And so there's this interesting juxtaposition between this openness that you're trying to cultivate among all these people in order for these relationships to work, and the secrecy that you need to protect your personal relationships with. And so I'm just wondering, is that something that you have to deal with much in your practice?
Definitely, children is an area where a lot of people have concerns, both about coming out and also how the children will be affected. I have a whole chapter about children in the new book, Polyamory in the 21st Century. But let me just say briefly that if people are struggling with this issue, I usually ask them to consider if they can relocate to a part of the country where it's less stigmatized. Because this is really, you know, I think more the issue than running into trouble with the authorities is, not fitting in with friends and neighbors. And in the Bay Area, the gays and lesbians, bisexuals face the same kinds of issues and have for a long time. And so in the Bay Area, a lot of people just kind of, you know, don't get too excited about the idea. And I think even in more conservative parts of the country, this is starting to change because there's so many kids that actually do have multiple mothers and fathers. They're just not all married at the same time. They're exes. And so people have gotten used to the idea. So it's just a little bit of a stretch. Well, gee, what would be wrong with having two moms and not be divorced?
Right, exactly. That's an interesting idea. So, we're going to be running out of time here, and I still have more questions to ask you. But I want people to know where they can find you and your book. So why don't you give them your website and the places where your book is available so that we can – and I'll have that on the site too. And just so you know, you can put this conversation up on your own site too. But so, Deborah, what's the best website for people to find you and your book?
My site is lovewithoutlimits.com. That's all one word, Love Without Limits. And you can click through from there to Amazon, where you can buy the new book at a big discount, as well as the older books directly on the website. There's also a fan page on Facebook, Polyamory in the 21st Century, where there's a lot of ongoing conversations about the book and people's polyamorous experiences, as well as updates on events that I'm doing.
So you do a lot of teaching and trainings around the country about polyamory. And if people have questions about practical advice, that was my last question. But, you know, if they're curious about this lifestyle and concerned about it, what would you recommend in terms of resources, besides your book, of course, or your several books, what would you recommend that people do to learn more? Or, you know, is there anything you would direct them to? You know, your events for sure, which are up on your site, but anything else, organizations or?
Right. Well, if you Google polyamory on the internet, you'll get about over a million responses. So there are polyamorous support groups and online discussion groups all over the world now. There's several on Facebook. And there's many Yahoo groups. There's the Loving More site.
Right.
there's a lot of resources out there. There's a lot of free articles on my site. And pretty much wherever you live, you probably can find a support group not too far away.
Okay. Well, that's really good to know. So one last time, Deborah, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show. You are a wealth of knowledge, and I really appreciate your honest responses to all my questions. So we've had Deborah Taj Annapol, the author of Polyamory in the 21st Century. You can find it on her website at lovewithoutlimits.com. You can email her directly through there as well. And she does do counseling about all these topics as well. And so, again, thank you so much. And everybody, have a great week. Thanks for joining us on Lunch with the Loveologist. We'll be here again next week. Take care.